What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games. I am your itinerant co-host, Mark Bigney, and with me is Michael Walker. How are you doing, Walker?
Hello, I'm doing very well.
I'm very glad to hear it. I am returned from the West Coast. I went to go out to the West Coast to visit our legions of fan.
You went to the sun.
I did. I went to the sun. 43 degrees in the shade, but it's a dry heat. And I mean that sincerely. It's not just a joke. I can take 43 degrees of dry heat over 25 and muggy any day of the darn week. And I should know, I've only lived in muggy climes. So it is absolutely a trade I'd make. And I was hosted very generously by Mark Posada of Board Game Barrage. We'll be talking about some of the games that we played together later. And it is very good to be back in Kingston with all of you. So we're going to be talking about board games this week. We're going to talk about the Eurus, the as-yet-unnamed retrospective intro segment, the game we reviewed last year. Then we're going to talk about the games we played last week. Then we're going to talk about the news and why it doesn't matter. And then finally, our topic. Our topic this week is 180s, games we've done a 180 on. So, Walker, what did we review last year?
Exactly 1 year ago, we played a game called Dwellings of Eldervale. Now, it's got a second printing lately, and it's remained on my shelf, oddly.
You still have it?
I still have it.
I'd assumed that was Warm Boy's copy.
No.
Oh, wow.
I don't know something about it. So many different factions that have different abilities. I think I just enjoy the mechanisms, not or how they come together, or I don't know what I like about it.
One of the things that I really like about Dwellings of Eldervale is the promise of being able to customize your tableau by having these slots generated by cards, and then you fill them in the tokens you acquire. But Luke Laurie also co-designed a game with Tom Jolly called Cryo, where you get to do that a lot more. And that is why I enjoy Cryo. Well, one of the reasons why I enjoy Cryo. I really did not enjoy Dwellings of Eldervale, which is why I can only attribute it to some sort of strange motive towards self-harm based whim that I pledged for the sci-fi version that will be fulfilling sometime in the next 7 years. I think you egged me on, if I remember correctly.
That's a lie.
Yeah,
I would never do such a thing.
I think I expressed some sort of vague, inchoate desire to see if the system could evolve in a direction that I enjoyed, and it did seem like the development work on Ascendancy, or at least what they were promising on the campaign page, were to address some of the concerns that people like us have raised about Dwellings of Eldervale. And I think then, remember, you held me... Yeah, now it's coming back to me. You held me upside down over a toilet saying, pledge or I'll give you a swirly. And then I pledged and you swirlied me anyway. Now I remember.
Swirly.
So that's Dwellings of Eldervale. We haven't played it since we reviewed it.
Not very many people have a dedicated swirly room. I don't mind paying the extra taxes. Here in Canada, we pay taxes based on how many bathrooms you have. And I'd gladly do it for my swirly room.
Now onto the games we played last week. Walker, what did you play last week?
We streamed Federation. Federation is a game we played a year or so ago. Even though it says it came out in 2022, here in North America, we got it almost a year later. This is designed by Dimitri Perrier and Matthew Verder. And it's put out by Explore 8, and it is a worker placement type game where your workers can be sort of two different things. You're either putting a value on the board, which is sort of area majority. You want one side to win over the other. And you also want to win the rows of the Senate as well. While you're doing all this, you're working on your tableau. You're doing all sorts of other things. I really enjoy everything about Federation. It has endgame scoring opportunities that can change every game. There's technologies you're doing. You're playing all these sort of little mini games. And you're figuring out how to get the resources you need that turn to do what you want to do.
I really enjoy Federation. My chief complaint about it when we reviewed it was that I felt that it was a little bit samey because there wasn't a whole lot to shake things up. You tend to end up in roughly the same place regardless. The same scoring conditions will come up every game. It's just a question of the order. And that absolutely changes your tactical horizons. But the strategic horizons of Federation, I felt somewhat repetitive. That having been said, I agree with you. All the bits are great and all the bits hang together really, really well. And I love how the worker placement is interspersed with this kind of twofold area majority contest.
And it's definitely like old school worker placement. All of the spaces matter. All of them get taken quickly. Yes.
It is absolutely tight. And the competition can get fierce, especially early on when those tactical cleavages are really important. So for example, near the end of the game, when it's a question of scoring track A versus track B, most people have maximized or close to maximized both of those tracks. But sometimes the early game, the mid game, where it's a question of track A versus track B, then there can be very large differences. And the competition over that I find very exciting. And so naturally, given that, I find the early rounds a little bit more compelling than the later rounds, and which is also a knock against the game. If a game like Federation, I find it peaks in the early rounds, I'd rather it build to a crescendo in terms of tempo and engagement. But as I say, these are all minor complaints overall. I think it's one of the better worker placement games, certainly of the past year, and I feel somewhat chagrined at having missed out on playing it, but again, given my objections, Federation is exactly the kind of game I'd probably want to play every other year or so and probably enjoy it a great deal when I do so. So I'm glad you got it back to the table. I'm glad it's going to stay in rotation. Broadly speaking, Federation's very, very well done.
And we got two of the projects done this game.
Oh, that's...
Isn't that crazy?
That's two more than sometimes happen.
It's true.
Congratulations.
That's Federation.
That's Federation.
Oh, and the components are top-notch.
Yeah, the deluxe version. Both versions are expensive in North America, but the deluxe version is very nice. I don't know if it's
your
worth
workers are poker chips and yeah.
I got to play Successors 4th Edition when I was with Mark Posada of Board Game Barrage. He mentioned that it was one of the games that he was vaguely considering playing, and I love Successors 4th Edition. I just like to point something out, though. I have a minor grievance. This is just about how I generally feel underappreciated. I'm not saying that based on the fact that I taught Successors 4th Edition from memory and impromptu with no major rules errors, that I deserve some kind of medal or statue or a parade. But if that happened, I'd know why. That's all I'm saying. And so Successors is a very, very originally an old school board game. It has evolved into a very old school in some ways, slightly more modern in others. Basically, the modern form of Successors took shape at Successors 3rd Edition. The differences between 3rd and 4th Edition are negligible, although it's kind of a good and a bad. I'll reiterate what I've said before about Successors 4th. In the one hand, they've reified the optional rules that a lot of people played with as a matter of course. So all the optional rules that I always played with are now part of the core rules, so I think that's good. Unfortunately, they added special abilities to all the generals, which is, you know, a very now thing to do. But the special abilities are really minor, except for when they're not, and they're easy to forget. So, for example, I'll just give one example of a general that I think is particularly problematic. They are immune to a particular kind of surprise card. You might build your entire turn on the basis of being able to win a fight on the basis of having that surprise card. It's specifically treachery. And then only to play that card, and then one of two things will happen. Either that just means that your entire plans were scuppered because you forgot about this one minor corner case, or equally likely, I think, the player controlling that general forgets that ability didn't play and then just feels bad about it after the fact, and then you don't know whether you want to rewind. Anyway, so going forward, I think I'm going to play without the general special abilities, frankly, because they were just tacked on in the latest edition, so I'll probably just get rid of them. And in point of fact, I think I might start consolidating some of the 3rd and 4th edition components, because there are some 3rd edition components that are vastly more user-friendly than the 4th edition components. But again, overall, these are minor quibbles. Successors is about the Wars of the Diadochi in the aftermath of Alexander the Great's death, and it is remarkably fluid for a multiplayer card-driven consim. So a lot of people, for example, talk about Sword of Rome. Sword of Rome is also a four-player, much later on, and historically speaking, in terms of time setting, but it's a card-driven consim. And what I don't like about Sword of Rome is that the battle lines are much more static. It's much more difficult to get yourself across the map. The victory conditions are much less interesting. And the CRT in Sword of Rome is wild. You can attack with a much stronger force in Sword of Rome and still end up being massacred because you rolled slightly less well than the opponent. It's all over the place. Whereas Successors, I find a remarkably tense balancing act of several competing victory conditions, as well as an excellent system of discouraging early conflict, except for when it really matters. And so you really have to pick your spots, but that's not because the CRT might hose you and the dice might completely wreck you. You have to pick your spots because you have to give up something often in order to attack. And anyway, I could and have spent a lot of time talking about how great Successors is. And ultimately, I felt that this was a very good session. It played out. There's a number of ways that the endgame can shake out in Successors. This one was driven primarily by the fact that the person who had Alexander the Great's funeral cart did not make a push to bury it in the capital of Macedon, and instead looked left, looked right, and said, "This place is full of people who want to kill me," and just buried it right in Babylon. That happens sometimes. It is what it is. And so I and the other generals then were left in the aftermath wondering what to do with that mess. It was great. I'll play Successors at any opportunity, whether it's planned or whether it's not. It's a solid 4 hours with rules explanation and setup, but I think it's 4 hours well spent. It's dynamic. It's fluid. It's really well done. People complain about the rules grit, but honestly, I think compared to a lot of other games of its ilk, it's pretty internalizable because you at least understand the victory conditions. For me, that is the last place where you want to have rules grit. That's why I don't like the coin games, for example. One of the reasons why it's like, okay, well, how do I win? It's like, well, follow the flow chart. If A obtains, you win if D and not C. But if B doesn't obtain, then etc.
Well, I want rules grit of that magnitude when the game goes for that length of time. Otherwise, it gets pretty stale pretty fast.
You mean rules grit in the victory conditions or rules grit overall?
Overall.
Oh, sure. That's fair. And I do think, although, again, I've been playing Successors for so long and often enough, some of the distinctions I will defend, some of them I won't. You know, there's a distinction about when you automatically place political control after a siege and when you don't. That's a distinction that's just arbitrary for the most part, and I completely understand why people keep forgetting. But other differences are really cool, like how Alexander's male heirs work differently than Alexander's female relatives. And that part's wonderful. Anyway.
How many new players were there?
I was the only experienced player of Successors at the table. This is often the case. which is rough, but it is what it is. I think the new players did a very good job. One player in particular did a very, very gutsy push into the Mediterranean and sieged Rhodes when I never would have, and he pulled it off, so good for him. That is Successors 4th Edition by Richard Berg and Mark Simonich, a whole bunch of development work by John Firer, published by Phalanx in 2022.
I got to play Gnar again. It is published by Bombix and designed by Thomas DuPont, and it's a fantastic, quick playing, full of decisions, like timing decisions, card game. You're deciding when to scuttle your engine a little bit to get a better scoring opportunities, when to, you know, use trade tokens, when to use your recruit tokens. I played two games of this. It was just sort of this odd, I don't even know if it means anything. I played with Butterfly, who's not a huge gamer, and we tied exactly.
Interesting.
And it came down to token. It's how many tokens you have left. And so I lost. And then I played with experienced gamers, and one player, you know, blew out. So does this mean that is there a random element, or is it just sort of someone made decisions differently? I'm not sure. Anyway, the art is fantastic. I love everything about Gnar. It doesn't last long, which is exactly what I like.
It's delicious and the portions are too small. Exactly. Yeah, I know. It's very tight and compact. On the topic of tight and compact, a game was demonstrated to me by Mark Posada called Trick Takers. This is a Japanese trick-taking game, and unlike other Japanese trick-taking games, it doesn't seek to overwhelm you with victory conditions, despite the fact that there are four of them. There are four different victory conditions, and when I heard that, I thought, oh great, this is going to be weird. But it's remarkably clean. Every special power that you draft every round has an auto-win condition. It's kind of like shooting the moon. If you win the outright majority of tricks of two rounds, you win the game. Failing that, if you go null for three rounds, you win the game. And then failing all that, it's points. And this I found remarkably interesting in terms of balancing the different conditions, how many tricks you want to win, and the number of points you win are largely a function of a score chart that the aforementioned character ability will give you. And some of them are downright weird, like, oh, you really want to win two or three tricks, but if you win four tricks, that's bad. You start losing points then, or things of that nature. But in the universe, in the overall ecosystem of the other victory conditions, I think it all shakes out. And so very quickly, by the second and third round, we immediately started looking at who we thought we could let win more tricks than the other, and all these other dynamics. Now, on top of that was the actual trick-taking, which I did not think was very good, because you play with a small subset of the deck, and consequently, you're not really in a position to know what's apt to happen, and so it felt very arbitrary on that level. Now, granted, this was just a first play, with more plays, maybe, but for example, one of the special abilities relies almost entirely on the presence of one type of card, in that they can only really be defeated if there's lots of this one card in play. You have no idea how many of those cards are in circulation when you take it. And it could be zero, in which case you're going to have a good run. Or a lot of people could have them, in which case you could be in trouble. And that part I really didn't enjoy. There's a small proportion of the deck in play coupled with that reliance on specific values being in people's hands.
Well, could it be like a fish? You got to fish them out first and then play? Or
they just might not be in the deck, period. It's just every round, you shuffle the entire deck of cards and deal out roughly half of the deck. And so you don't know where those valuable cards are. They might never see play at all. So it certainly seemed, based on the early rounds, that some of the roles seemed like vastly easier to play than others. I'm not going to say overpowered, but definitely for new players, they definitely seem vastly easier. Anyway, very interesting. It is only available in Japanese, but there are English paste-ups available if you're inclined to get a copy. I also have a copy independently, but I do not have the paste-up, so I'm going to have to print those up. I'd be curious to see what you think, because it definitely doesn't overstay its welcome. It's very quick and cheerful as far as these things go, because a lot of trick-taking games, although clever, last a little bit too long. Now, granted, they tend to last a little bit too long in part because they want there to be lots of hands so that the luck of the draw can balance out. So I'm not really sure where this all shakes out, but I was intrigued. So I'm interested to see more of Trick Takers. There's an expansion with yet more special powers and lots of variable setup conditions. With access to the English materials, I'm interested to give it another go. That is Trick Takers by Hiroken.
I'm definitely going to debate the definition of Trick Takers later.
Sure.
So you definitely take tricks in this game, right?
Yes, in Trick Takers.
And the number of tricks that you take matters. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Okay. we'll revisit that in a moment.
Okay, we'll put a pin in that one.
All right, so we got to play Fate Forge, Chronicles of Khan! All right.
I was waiting for someone to do that. All right, thanks for being sufficiently predictable, Walker.
This is designed by Gordon Clea and published by Mighty Boards. And hold on to your hats. It's a campaign system, and we're playing it.
I know.
And it is very reminiscent of their dice game.
Vengeance.
Vengeance. Roll and fight. You have...
More so just Vengeance, I think.
Vengeance. You have these recipe cards, and you have four dice in your pool. And you get to sub out these dice as you get items and spells or just upgrades. You get to upgrade these dice, but it's always going to be four. And you get to decide which four you're going to roll. And then you fulfill the recipes and it does damage or lets you move, lets you do things.
Well, the biggest difference I would say in terms of the actual dice resolution is that, like Vengeance, mostly you're using the dice for the values of the dice. Sometimes you use them to activate special abilities, as opposed to Vengeance Roll and Fight, where you're exclusively resolving recipes.
And it is joyously quick. You set out the map, you put out the discs for the enemies, they have minimalistic abilities and what they do. The app will bring you through what happens. You do your quick fight. If with some help, I think the next session is going to be even better because we'll sort of assign jobs and get the maps out faster. And we went through two dungeons?
Two and a half
dungeons in one session, which wasn't that long. And all the different characters are interesting. They all sort of play quite differently from each other. I love how the fact that, much like in Vengeance, you get that free move. It helps move the game along. All of these things are leading to the story is not terrible. In fact, it's quite funny in some cases.
It's darkly comic the way we've been reacting to it, right?
Yes.
So we tried a pre-production version when before Fateforge was on crowdfunding. And my key misgivings, above and beyond the fact that it's another fantasy campaign game, but my key misgivings off of the app were that it's got app integration. The app was buggy, but that's to be expected. It kind of convinced me that that was the last time we should play a pre-production app-driven game. I think it was a bad call. I don't think we should do it again. Because the app is usually the last thing to get ironed out. And the app needs to be locked down tight in order for the game to function, right? Any small mistake in the app and suddenly everything blows up. And sure enough, several times at the time, I struggled with some technical issues, but I'm not going to belabor the point. So I was concerned about the app, and I was also concerned about the writing, and I was concerned about the storyboarding because it wasn't really doing it for me. And so it was some trepidation, especially since even good campaigns often start out slow. And so when sitting down to Fateforge, I'm like, how long are we going to have to go through before we get to new stuff and or if new stuff is really good? And the answer was about a paragraph. Because I'm not going to claim to be desperately, like, fully invested in the story and the characters, but interesting stuff started happening right away.
Yeah, because it has a person distress, and usually, you know, you know they're dependent on you. In this case, no. They are a whirling death machine, and you wonder why they're a person in distress. Like, why am I even here?
There were some unexpected turns, without going into too much detail, and without getting into any more spoilers than you've already inflicted on an unsuspecting audience, Walker. So the writing is good enough to keep me diverted, and the scenario is not entirely predictable. So it's already better than a lot of other campaign systems that I've seen over the past few years. And it is largely on the strength of the designer's past work, Gordon Kalea, and the fact that we love Vengeance and really enjoy Vengeance Roll and Fight, that we're giving Fateforge Chronicles of Khan the rope that we are. And I'm glad that we are. This is the first campaign I've been interested in trying for a very long time, and thus far it is not disappointing. What it has done with the basic dice system is really well, really good. And I will just stress, as the person who was responsible for sorting components and doing a fair amount of the setup, they have been very conscientious at Mighty Boards in terms of designing a package that is as user-friendly as possible so that you can pack it in quickly, set it up quickly, get to the next scenario quickly, because otherwise it could just be a slog. And so far, I really think that Fateforge Chronicles of Khan is something that I could see myself sticking with. Now, it's the biggest knock against it, I think, in terms of its longevity as a campaign, is that it is not very flexible with respect to player count and with respect to player identity. You can swap classes. That's easily done in the context of the app. But player count can only be swapped in between acts, of which there are going to be three. So that's unfortunate. You need the same crew, or at least a willingness for people to swap in roles. Again, Oathsworn is the gold standard for how to swap in and out. Gloomhaven does a pretty good job as well, but I think Oathsworn definitely takes the crown for that degree of flexibility. Other than that, I am very enthusiastically looking forward to more Fateforge Chronicles of Khan, because the gameplay is tight, and so far the campaign systems are not making me sad.
Fateforge by Mighty Boards.
Got to play the Plum Island Horror. This is a GMT Games release from last year, and it's one of their crossover kinds of things. GMT every once in a while publishes something that doesn't really belong in the GMT catalog, and the Plum Island Horror absolutely qualifies. It's got a pulpy comic book aesthetic from the midpoint of the 20th century, and it is a co-op game that is much, much lighter and completely ahistorical when compared to other GMT fare. It was designed by Herman Luttman, who has designed Dawn of the Zeds, and it is very much similarly a sort of vaguely tower defense-y, but not quite zombie survival co-op game. It almost works. There's a lot of thematic stuff there. Like, for example, one of the key goals in the Plum Island Horror is rescuing these civilians, but all the civilians have a specific identity. Like, these are the employees of the insurance salesman shop. This is a particular family. These are the survivalists, whatever. And this keys off of specific narrative events that you can trigger deliberately over the course of the game, as well as key off of random events automatically. Like, for example, if a particular kind of mid-boss gets spawned and the survivalists are in play, they might cause the boss to spawn with one damage. This is kind of cute. Overall, it was pretty cute. The biggest slight I have against the Plum Island Horror, though, is pacing. You have two objectives. Number one, evacuate a certain number of civilians. And then number two, survive. And I was hoping, and it certainly seemed in the early stages, as though it was going to be a bit of a lift to evacuate the necessary number of civilians, because a number of conditions have to be in play. It turns out that my estimations were totally off. It was very easy to evacuate the necessary number of civilians. We had done it before the midpoint had rolled around. And then we're left with not a whole lot to do, because we're just there to survive. And a lot of the characters aren't good at fighting. So they have very little to do, which is fine. You only have a certain number of actions to do. But all you end up doing is you have your characters that are good at fighting kill the large threatening hordes that might end up causing you to have a loss condition. That's about it. And there's a lot of upkeep from round to round. There's this chit pull activation sequence, which is fine. I generally enjoy chit pull activation sequences, but the problem is that there are vastly more chit pulls that relate to busy work than relate to player characters actually doing something. So you're spawning mobs, you're moving mobs, you're having events trigger, this, that, and the other, and people are just waiting for them their opportunity to do something. And when you've already accomplished your big victory condition, you're just waiting for the game to end so you can declare victory, that can get real tedious. And so that was my ultimate perception of the tail end of the Plum Island Horror. If they could have maintained the level of engagement in some of, say, the second half of the first half, so like the mid-quarter, then things might have been okay. Because the early rounds are tedious because you have so few actions, but then you ramp up in the number of actions it's programmed by the game itself. Then you're actually able to engage with the game properly, but then you very quickly find the victory condition obtained. And it's just, okay, well, we're just spinning our heels. So apparently in an expansion, there might be additional modes that make the game more difficult. The designer has stated that he wanted, you know, a family weight beer and pretzel kind of thing. And so made it a little bit easy. I would point out two things. Number one, just because it's light doesn't mean it has to be easy, especially at the expense of tempo. And number two, I am constantly amazed at what wargamers think of as light and family weight and beer and pretzels, because the Plum Island Horror is a lot lighter than a lot of other GMT games. It's still about a 25-page rulebook, so there's more rules, I think, than what could be tolerated by your average family weight game. So I was interested to try it. I found the setting kind of cool. I found some of the thematic flourishes very enjoyable and amusing. But overall, in terms of pacing and the overall mechanical level of the Plum Island Horror, I was left somewhat cold. So I don't think I'll be going back to Plum Island and for its horror.
Have you played Carnival Zombie before?
I have not played Carnival Zombie.
Interesting. Well, we'll definitely have to try to get a copy of that then. Because it's very much the same sort of thing. It's much more tower defense-y, but there's like the larger bosses and you have to do your, and it's like a quick moving zombie type defense game with a dexterity element.
Yes, I of course I'm down for the dexterity element. You know it.
You and I return to Sky Team. This is designed by Luc Raymond and put out by Lucky Duck Games. I get the feeling from like trick-taking games when you're trying to give your partner inferences about what you have in your hand by what you're playing and where you're playing it. This is, you know, the other part of it. It's like, I'm going to put the six here, and it needs to send the message that this is obviously one of many sixes I have,
right,
just by that placement.
No, I agree. I think the subtle communication. So you're not allowed to talk. And I agree with you that the placement is used to evoke some of that indirect communication that is typically found in trick-taking games. That's exactly right. So we managed to successfully land a plane in Kuala Lumpur. I remain morbidly amused by the fact that in Sky Team, you either land the plane and get a round of applause, or everyone dies. Whee! This is one of my first experiences with some of the additional modules, because every airport has a different set of challenges. And so in this particular one, we had to deal with mountain ranges and fuel requirements. And that was really cool. I enjoy seeing the different parameters. And I have to say, for a very, very simple game, what constantly striking me about Sky Team is every round you have four dice and two of those dice have to go in a specific place. And so you're really only playing with the order and B, two extra dice. And whenever I think about that structure, I always think there can't be much of a game here. And yet in the actual play of Sky Team, it is remarkably difficult to determine what to place and how.
Yeah, I enjoy it every time. You're playing with your speed, the pitch of your plane. You're trying to get there's all these different check marks you have to get by the time you land. You got to get your brakes up. And like Mark said, all these different little modules that you're adding. You have this whole sort of, I want to say, deck of different airports. And they get increasingly harder. There's going to be an expansion soon. So I can see more Sky Team in the future. Does not outstay its welcome.
So not everyone is personally despised by Contention Games and its various fulfillers, because other people have their copies of Slay the Spire, the board game. And I was Yes, I was fortunate enough to play one of those copies that is definitely not ever going to be sent to me, regardless of how many unanswered emails I have. And I find Slay the Spire, the board game, to be, and I say this about a number of things, but I think it's very appropriate here as well, the answer to a question that no one asked. And that is, how do we take this digital game that is 100% a card game and turn it into a physical version? Because anyone who's played Slay the Spire, the original PC game, it's entirely a card game. It's not hiding it. It's not subtle about it. That's what it is. It's a deck builder. And so making a physical version, one might ask why. And the answer is because when you make it multiplayer, things can get more interesting. Because suddenly now it's very much about threat triage and attacking other people's threats and helping other people defend or mitigate this, that, or the other, or dealing damage to somebody else's monster and leaving yours alone because you can tank it, etc., etc., etc. You know, all that quality discussion that you get in your good co-op games.
I'm going to say it's going to have that, because if it doesn't, people are just going to say, well, what's the point?
Well, then there's the fact that some people just prefer the analog experience. I am one of those people, but even then, I was skeptical. But I have to say, the nature of the cooperation and the quality of the development work has won me over, because A, I love co-ops, and B, the overall development work is a non-trivial lift, because as you might imagine from a digital game, there are lots of trailing effects and lots of modifiers and lots of math that the PC takes care of for you. For example, you might have a build that relies very much on poison, and suddenly you're stacking stacks on stacks of poison, and your goal is to get various enemies to like 12 stacks of poison that trigger every turn, or even more outre and elaborate and baroque modifiers. There are people in the Slay the Spire community, Walker, that refer to themselves exclusively by what ascension level they've reached.
Ah, I see.
Anything less than A20, I'm told, is nothing but a despicable scrub. As a representative of those despicable scrubs.
I was going to say, I didn't even realize there was a number. I've played tons of Slay the Spire. I didn't even
Are you an A20? Well, then L2P, Nub.
Apparently. What does that even mean?
That means that you have defeated the heart at ascension level 20.
Oh.
Preferably with all characters.
Oh, I see. I only play one character. So that's probably the problem there.
What character is that?
The first one.
Okay.
I just enjoy...
The Ironclad. Yeah, okay. Anyway, moving on. So what they've done at Contention Games is they've done a number of obvious things. They've eliminated some modifiers entirely. They've simplified the math for other modifiers. They've adapted the cards shockingly well in light of that. For example, for those of you in the know, there's this status called Artifact in the video game, which means prevent the next status effect that targets you. They've gotten rid of Artifact in the card game. In the actual card game, the way that it works instead is instead of giving you Artifact, what it does is it clears negative statuses. And, you know, it seems like a relatively obvious choice, but these are the kind of decisions they have to make dozens and dozens of times to have cards work mostly the same way in a comparatively more parsimonious universe of modifiers and where the math is simpler. They've also done some other reaches, like some cards work radically differently because they couldn't figure out a way to make it work. The other thing that they've done in terms of the math is they've just flattened the damage curve. So, for example, again, in the PC game, strikes might do 5 damage or 6 damage or 7 damage, case depending. Or various other attacks might do 4 damage or 6 or what have you. In the board game, most everything just does 1 damage. Screw it. We're going to flatten everything. And consequently, the difference between something that does 1 damage and 2 damage is huge. And similarly, the effect of poison becomes much higher. Remember I said before, in the PC game, you might want to try to get a stack of 12 poison before it might be seriously consequential. Well, in the board game, 1 poison is seriously consequential, because that's effectively a free card play every turn in terms of damage output. And having played a full game of Slay the Spire, the board game, I am shocked at how well they did all of the balancing. Not because I had any particular suspicion towards Contention Game. We really, really like Imperium the Contention, their previous offering. And there was a lot of really good design work in that project as well. But it wasn't the same kind of tricky math balancing necessarily than taking the universe of almost all of the cards represented in Slay the Spire, or a substantial proportion of them, and turning them into an analog version while changing the math and changing the modifiers and changing all this other stuff. It must have been a tremendous amount of work. And as a user who is passingly familiar with the PC game and playing with other people who are very familiar with the PC game, I have to say I'm thoroughly impressed with the job they've done. Now, is it going to convert everybody? into wanting to play this when they could just play the PC game? Well, a lot of that is going to depend on your priors. What kind of gamer are you? How long does it take you to point at something and say, I'd rather have a PC automate this for you? If that kicks in very quickly, like my friend Josephus, that kicks in for him very, very quickly, I don't think Slay the Spire the board game is going to change your mind at all. But you, Walker, I'm cautiously optimistic that you're really going to enjoy the co-op aspects.
How is the, like, the component sprawl or the component manipulation?
Very manageable.
Oh, good.
They did a very good job with that as well. Now, in terms of an overall arc of play, every act took roughly 45 minutes-ish. So if you're going to play all three acts in one sitting, if you survive to all three acts, it's going to be reasonably long. But it's really designed to be played act by act. So, you know, play an act, call it a day, if you're so inclined. And frankly, having played two acts at once and then delaying the end of the third act, I'd be more than happy to play it either way. So I've kind of tried it both ways, even though I've only played it the once. It's a really well-done design. If you've never played Slay the Spire, but like co-op deck builders, I think Slay the Spire is going to make you very happy. If you're a big fan of the PC game, I think a lot is going to depend on your priors and how much you prefer analog versions and how much you really want to see the math evolve. Frankly, I was really surprised by how much pleasure I got at just seeing how cards changed and why. It was like watching the minds of the developers at work, and I was very impressed.
Yeah, I very much got that feeling in World of Warcraft, the board game, where they had all the characters there and how they used all the current abilities of those characters and how they turned them into card forms and or abilities. It was, I can't wait. I'm very much looking forward to playing it.
Oh, good. So that's Slay the Spire, the board game, designed by Gary Dworetsky, Anthony Giovanetti, and Casey Yano, published by Contention Games. Contention Games keeps threatening to reprint Imperium of Contention with new expansions, which is great because there is a large number of people, some of whom I think even listen to this podcast, who have been very eagerly awaiting a chance to try Imperium of Contention.
So on the tail end of Dr. Stallone's visit, he asked to play Gaia Project. And so there's been a ton of Gaia. In fact, we played it twice. And after that, there's been a ton of online Gaia Project going on. And it's interesting at the sort of ramp up from going to playing it like once a year and, you know, midway through the game, remembering how to, you know, work the levers to not only knowing how to work the levers, but, you know, working them in a much better way. So, you know, you go from 99 points to, you know, 150 points, and then it's getting more and more, and I'm just enjoying it that much more. Looking forward, there's going to be an expansion soon. This is put out by Fruiterland Spiel and designed by Jean Dugmuller and Holge Ostertag. And for those that don't know, it's very much you stay in the round until you sort of run out of resources. You're trying to get this engine building that's going to continuously generate resources, and you just keep taking actions until you decide to pass. So the more resources you have, the more actions you can take. There are actions that disappear. You have that sort of Mandela moving these energy cubes around as a sort of mini game that are going to let you take actions that can only be taken once per player. Or once per round, I guess, for all the players. So once it's gone. So there's sort of this race. You look around to see who has power ready to spend. Should I take that extra ore now before anyone else can? There's other abilities that you use green cubes from. Same sort of thing. Once per round. Should I do this now? Should I wait? Should I get to that planet before someone else takes it? It's a very closed sort of system. You need to jump around. You can only sort of advance one space at the beginning. And I love how the tech track works as opposed to the other Terra Mysticas. All of your abilities are listed there. It's like, well, how far can I terraform? Well, there it is. How many can I terraform? How far can I go? It's all in that tech tree, and you can get them all improved. Gaia Project, still by far, in my opinion, the best Terra Mystica there is.
Got to play another Japanese card game, this one called Nana, which is Japanese for seven. It was republished in other languages under the name Trio, designed by Kaya Miano and originally published by Mob Plus in 2021. And this is very simple. You've got a deck of cards, three copies of each number, and your job is to form sets of three, or trios, if you will. And there are face-down cards in the middle that you can flip up, and so there's a memory element there. You have to try to remember what people have in their hands and what's on the table, because all you do as an action is just reveal cards, and you're trying to reveal matches. And actually, it was Huey that drew the comparison between this and Scout, because in both Nana and Scout, you cannot rearrange your hand. Well, you can rearrange your hand in Nana, but the only cards that are relevant are your highest card and your lowest card. And so you ask, say, see Walker's lowest card. He shows that it's a three. You remember vaguely that somebody else had a three, or maybe that there was a three at the table. You try to find that, and then there you go. You're on your way to forming a set. And the reason why it's called Nana in the original Japanese version is because if you ever form sets that sum or subtract to seven, so, you know, a set of seven, you win, a two and a five, an 11 and a four, you get the idea. Then you get to shout seven and win or something. Apparently in the trio version, this is called the spicy version.
Ooh, that does sound spicy.
Yes, that's how I live my life.
Ooh, on the
siempre edge. Caliente, Walker. Ooh. Anyway, so I thoroughly enjoyed Nana. I was able to repurpose my deck of Regicide that I take with me everywhere I go in my purse to form a quick Nana deck and got to show it to the boys. Had a great time. It's very simple, enjoyable. People flub, you know, two fives are on the table. Everyone starts looking left, looking right, wondering, does he remember where the five is? Do they remember? Wait, do I have a? No, I don't have a. Where's the five? So it becomes a little that's not hat-ish in terms of desperately wishing you could remember where things were. It's pleasant, quick, enjoyable, easily proxied.
Good decision-making. You could, because you have to, in order to get that third action, you have to have your first two guesses have to be the same number. And then you can get to the point where you don't want to flip over a card in the middle. So you just flip over one that everyone knows. Or you ask yourself, you know, what's my lowest card, knowing that everyone's already seen it. So you just sort of like, so you don't reveal new information to the table.
Yeah, information management is absolutely part of Nana. I liked it. I probably won't get a copy because, again, it's so easily proxied. I don't know. Does that make me a bad person? A little bit?
A little bit.
Okay.
If it is available, in my opinion, it is available and you wish to play it more often, then you should buy a copy.
What if it's available, but it's owned by someone tied on a trolley track, and on the other side of the trolley track, there are five copies of a bootleg version of Pandemic, and...
Is it a Wednesday?
Ooh, I'll get back to you on that one.
We also got to play Murray the A-Hole Frog. This is designed by Jana Felly and put out by Devious Weasel Games.
So this is a review copy we got from the publisher.
And off the top, not a game for me, but still kind of enjoyable. It goes on for a long time, much longer than it is. And it's very much sort of like a take that type game where you sort of, I happen to reveal randomly a card and now I'm going to play it on a person and sort of erase the majority of the game for that person so far.
Maybe, now, like, that person, Walker, shouldn't have been so aggressive in throwing their wasps around in round one. And so then when Murray comes to eat all your flies, it's your fault, Walker, not anyone else's.
Look, I am understanding. There are a lot of people that like this type of game. I'm just not one of them.
I generally don't like take that games, but I have to say that Jana Felly has cracked the formula, and I do like Jana Felly's take that games. So I think the peerless masterwork in the genre is Doer of the Lesser Houses. And one of the key things that one has to do in order to make a take that game enjoyable for my tastes is you have to find a way to channel the aggression such that there are no hard feelings. You need there to be spite. You need there to be harm. But you can't let there be a bad vibe. The big trick.
I love that one part of the game where there was a back and forth of canceling, back canceling, and then that part was interesting. But
you like that part because you won that exchange, Walker.
Maybe. True.
No. So in getting back to my point, Door of the Lesser Houses accomplishes this largely by emphasizing that that's all you do. You don't build up points in Doer. You just take points from other people. You just like, oh, I heard that they were last visibly seen with somebody who was matching polka dots and stripes. Like, ooh, scandalo. And in Murray the A-Hole Frog, the thing that takes your points away from you is Murray. And so everyone naturally, I love this, everyone naturally comes to the same conclusion. You play the Murray on somebody, and it's like, why did you do this to me? And the answer is obvious. I didn't do it. Murray did. Nobody likes Murray. He's an a-hole. And it works. I don't know why it works. It's such a dumb fiction, but I love it. It's great. It's glorious. And so what's left after that is a relatively simple rummy game that works. It's perfectly functional. And it manages to keep... I'm surprised you found it too long. So with the rules revisions, the original version, we tried an earlier pre-publication version. And there I thought the pacing was a little off. I didn't really... it was missing another couple of mechanisms, one related to the end game, specifically the Hawk, and another one related to tadpoles, which is kind of a consolation prize, and an encouragement to spread out the Murray pain. Again, acknowledging the lie that it's actually not Murray doing the pain, it's specific players. But I think the revisions are all for the good. I really liked the pacing. I thought it was fine.
I know. Just for me. For a game where your progression is constantly being wiped, it just seemed to... It's like if progress is going to continually be wiped, can we just get to the part where we finish?
But that's just it. That's why the timing of the end game is so interesting. You start looking at the thickness of the deck. You start looking at your hand capacity. You start looking at everyone else's tableau and say, okay, is this the time when can I safely play out my set so as to give myself more freedom with respect to my hand? Or is that just going to make me a target for Murray? And sometimes the answer is you got to wait. And sometimes the answer is you just got to accept the fact that you're going to be predated upon. And having internalized that, I found it difficult to maintain any hard feelings, and I was definitely able to go with the flow and just have fun playing cards for special powers and waiting for Murray to come out, and the Hawk comes out, and then you're wondering when the game is going to end. I thought it was really well done.
Yeah,
much lighter than pretty much anything else Devious Weasel has ever done, including the mirroring of Mary King. So I think this is very much the sort of beer and pretzels slash very light card game experience that a lot of people are looking for in terms of card game take that stuff.
Yeah, maybe next time we play, I should just diversify more, put out much more smaller sets and not worry about them getting nuked because I have many more to fall back on.
It's true. There is a decision space in Murray the A-Hole Frog, despite how light it is and despite how confrontational it is. And again, it's not the kind of genre that exists for people who want to build up something and then feel regret over it's gone. You just have to kind of roll with it. I respect the fact that you're not inclined to. Most of the time, I'm not inclined to either. But again, I think Jenna Feli has found a way to crack the code. And she's just able to design these take-that games to my particular preferences. At the same time, though, I think that people who enjoy take-that games, who enjoy those kind of silly, like, who love playing Uno and wrecking people's hands and things like that, I think it would still appeal to them as well, so... I hope that a lot of people are able to enjoy Murray the A-Hole Frog. I love the framing. I love the theming. I think the card play does exactly what it's supposed to do. And I also really liked how the new endgame works. That's Murray the A-Hole Frog by Jenna Feli at Devious Weasel Games.
We also get to play Jenga Maker by Hasbro.
Who's the designer there?
Hasbro.
Okay. Hasbro. Got it.
And it has, you know, we've talked about Team 3 and... And it's that sort of thing where one person is dictating what the other person is building. It's a little more open than Team 3. There's not that many more limitations.
Yeah, it's one person isn't blindfolded, for example.
Exactly. So you're just telling the person what to do, and you got to make sure you keep your hands to yourself, no pointing or telling you, just telling them to rotate, spin, you know, or pirouette or...
And throttling in frustration is explicitly not allowed.
And when you say spin and they keep spinning it the same way and you say no, and so then they spin it the same way again, it does get a little frustrating sometimes.
I'm so sorry. It's the same problem. I am glad that we have not resorted to the obvious kludge. Right? There's an obvious kludge where we would just all get together and stipulate, okay, this is what spin means. This is what rotate means. But the fact that we haven't done that
that would take all the fun.
Yeah. I know exactly. It's great.
So you have a pitcher, and you are trying to get your teammate to build that pitcher identical to the way it is on the card with blocks. They're all different colors and different shapes, and there's a little bit of dexterity element to it. Unfortunately, we did once again find pitchers that had sort of hidden blocks where you just sort of make inferences on how that block would be placed because
specifically
it's hidden by other blocks.
Specifically the U.
Yeah.
And the only way you could tell which orientation the U was supposed to be was by looking at the bottom of the picture, noticing that the gap was there because where the gap would be at the top was entirely obscured based on the perspective.
It was a sliver of the gap.
Yeah. It was a little bit of a sour note because otherwise one of the great charms of Jenga Maker is that the little things that you build are often surprisingly evocative and kind of cute.
Yeah, so that's another mini game we have at the end. Everyone finishes their little sculptures and then we try to guess before we look at the card of what you know, we depicted with the blocks.
And 9 times out of 10, and I'll stand by that ratio, this is not just a turn of phrase, after you're told what it's supposed to be, the answer is, oh, wow, I can see that. Sometimes it's, really? But that's by far the minority. That is Jenga Maker. We get to try Arcs. This is very preliminary, because Arcs is by Cole Worley, and Arcs is very Cole Worley. Because oftentimes, root notwithstanding, your first experience with a Cole Worley game is, wait, how do I? Oh, okay. Even when it's relatively mechanically simple. Arcs is relatively mechanically simple. But the trick is, in order to score any points, an ambition needs to be declared. And the ambition's relatively straightforward. Like, for example, Warlord is, how many kills have you done? Or how many of these kinds of resources do you have? So you need to accumulate those things, and the ambition needs to be triggered. But to trigger the ambition, you need to have the right card and be in the lead so as to be able to lead what is kind of sort of almost a trick. You have objections, though, with it being characterized
as
a trick.
Well, I was just thinking today, like, they call it a trick-taking game, but you don't actually take any of the tricks.
It's true.
So, and there's no, there's just so, it's so out of what trick-taking is that it,
In their defense, the extent to which it is presenting itself as a trick-taking game or a game with trick-taking elements is has been exaggerated largely by people not associated with the development team. Especially latterly, they talk about it how it has some mechanical elements influenced by trick-taking or something of that. They always attenuate the statement and qualify it a great deal. So if you got the impression that it was like that it was fundamentally a trick-taking game with some other stuff going on, that is a misapprehension caused by me, and for this I apologize.
And I think it causes more problems than it helps.
Don't you dare blame that confusion on me.
It's not you. I'm not saying you. I'm just saying that it's a trick-taking game because it's fairly rules-heavy, and the gameplay, saying that it's trick-taking leads to a lot of inferences.
That's fair. You're right. I should stop.
There. So you think, okay, well, I can I do this? No, because it's not, that's not that kind of tricking game.
You're right. It's entirely my...
And the whole time we were playing Arcs, all I could think of was, oh my God, this is Inish all over again.
Yeah, I'm getting some Inish vibes, yeah.
Because some people, and there's not a problem, if they want to play heads down and worry about what they're doing and not care what the other players are doing, that's fine. You can't do that in games like Inish and Arcs.
Yes.
Because you will give the game away to other players because they have a scoring opportunity. And if you just feed them into the scoring opportunity by just doing what you want to do and not understanding or not looking to see what's going on,
right,
it's going to break the game.
I don't know that we necessarily encountered that in our one playing. We were all very much playing around with levers that we did not understand. I only really got the sense that I had a notion about what to do about halfway through. And I then only started, like, I had a notion about how to do that remotely approaching competently a few turns after that. So I'm very curious. So I was originally hopeful that the sort of campaign system, it's got an expansion, which is a campaign system where you play 3 games of Arcs and it's a little mini campaign. I was hopeful for that, but the problem is that I was hoping that the game would be shorter because somewhat closer to the tempo of a full game of Slay the Spire, for example, of 3 45-minute to an hour acts rather than 3 90-to-120-minute acts, right? Because there, you're starting to talk about the social burdens of an actual campaign system rather than, hey, we've got a long PlayStation coming up. Why don't we knock out an entire campaign of Arcs? Furthermore, although I'm very curious about the expansion rules, I'm not terribly optimistic about how much texture you're going to get because it's all very mechanical and very abstract and very strange. It's kind of sort of nominally a 4X-y kind of thing with like spaceships moving around and exploiting various planets. But really, it's just very, very weird. And sometimes Cole really does weird in a way I really enjoy. Root is an absolute classic of the modern hobby era. And I very much enjoyed the various iterations of John Company, even though it was clunky at times and strange in other ways. But then there's Oath, which was just weird in my experience, or An Infamous Traffic, which was just creaky in my experience. And I fear Arcs, so far, just one play in, I'm curious to see more, felt more to me like Oath in the terms of, I see what you're trying to do, but it's obscured by the strange mechanical choices here kind of vibe as far as my reactions go as a player.
And it has that root. There's a end game part of Root where when someone hits a certain score, the game will be over. And they have this in Arcs as well. But in Root, your movement is very limited on who you can influence and or react to and or predate upon.
Really?
In a way.
I think it depends on what factions are in play, frankly.
True. But I mean, like, it's a lot more restrictive than it is in Arcs. I felt Arcs, you can almost go anywhere.
Really?
And if someone's about to win, it is very easy to sort of gang up on them.
Huh.
Especially because the rounds last longer than they do in Root.
Well, I mean, Root doesn't even really have a round structure. You just keep taking turns until it's done. And
that's what I mean. Like, it's a single action, and you hit 30, and you win. Whereas in Arcs, there's like 6 actions per player, and then you hit. And then if you hit 30, you're done.
I'm having difficulty drawing the same connections you are. I'll be curious. I'll try to pay attention next time. Because if anything, I found my ability to move around the map in Arcs to be overly circumscribed, frankly. There were just all these people in my way. As opposed to Root, where normally, give me a couple of move actions, I can probably mess with someone's business. Interesting. Different reactions. So more to follow in all likelihood. That was Arcs, designed by Cole Worley. Published by Later Games this year after successful crowdfunding. Also with art by Kyle Ferrin. But I didn't find the art nearly as appealing here that is in Root. I mean, every card in Root tells a story. Sci-fi art, I think, just isn't really his medium in the same way.
Yeah, I did not see it like I did in Root.
Yeah. But as we say, more to follow. I'm curious to give it at least a couple more tries to try to at least play one game where I felt like I knew what I was doing. Although that may take forever. Who knows?
And those are the games we played this week. Now for a quick break to pay the bills.
This week's episode is sponsored by Incogni. Every time I've been to a bank in the past year, I've overheard someone ask if a recent phishing email or text or other message they've received was actually been from their bank. I get it. These scammers have powerful tools at their disposal, thanks to data brokers that traffic in your private information without your knowledge. The good news is that you have access to tools too. Incogni is a service that automatically removes your private data from the brokers that are all too happy to sell your privacy away as though you were the product. And since these data brokers can scrape your data again without your permission, Incogni will keep getting that data removed as many times as it takes while you have a subscription. Ever since I signed up with Incogni, I've had a drastic decrease in the number of robocalls, spam emails, and other scams from people trying to spoof email addresses of my friends and family. So try Incogni now. Use code aboutgames at incogni.com/aboutgames to get an exclusive 60% off an annual Incogni plan. That's code aboutgames at incogni.com/aboutgames. It's all too easy to spend over $100 a month on streaming services. Netflix, Disney Plus, Prime, you name it. But if you use ExpressVPN, you can cut back to just Netflix and save a bundle every month. You can use ExpressVPN to change your online location to over 100 different countries and access the unique media libraries available in those regions. No more having content hidden from you. ExpressVPN is unobtrusive, fast, works on almost any kind of device, all while protecting your privacy online. I've been hearing rave reviews about Scavenger's Reign, and thanks to ExpressVPN, I've been watching it on American Netflix. Like anime? Well, pretend to be in the UK, and you can watch the original Cowboy Bebop, not that other version. It's so simple. You just open the app, select a country, and refresh your browser to be wherever you want and watch what people in your country normally can't. So go for it. Get access to more and pay less. Get your money's worth at expressvpn.com/sowronggames. Don't forget to use my link at expressvpn.com/sowronggames to get an extra 3 months of ExpressVPN for free.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And we're back with the news and why it doesn't matter. A little bit of sad news and then a little bit of silly news. So Game Brewer, unfortunately, is closing up shop. lots of games that we enjoy from Game Brewer, like Stroganoff, Oak, Gugong, games like that. Now gone.
It is a shame. Similarly, in terms of shuttering various products and publishers, Atomic Mass Games, the subsidiary of FFG, which was a subsidiary of Asmodee, which is a subsidiary of the Embracer Group, etc., although sold at various levels, has announced the official cancellation of X-Wing and Armada, the two Star Wars spaceship games. Now, Armada had been de facto canceled a long time ago, but X-Wing was a bit of a surprise, given how successful it had been. And so that is a strange lacuna in the market now.
That's just part of their plan. You see, they took it from Fantasy Flight
mm-hmm.
just to kill Fantasy Flight, but pretend that they actually still wanted it.
Oh, sure.
And then so this was just sort of like a...
So now they can kill this one.
Yeah, it's like, oh, is it? Oh, now we're totally going to take away. Oh, geez. Yeah.
Sure.
No, I'm just joking. I'm not sure why. It seems like there's a new Star Trek spaceship game coming out that is going to be pre-painted models as well, so I'm not sure what is holding them back. Who knows? X-Wing was huge.
It was. And then it wasn't.
And maybe it's not so much anymore. Who knows? The silly news is we can't say Meeple anymore, Mark. So when we talk about game components, apparently, unless we want to be sued by Hans M. Gluck, we have to call them something else. Let's call them Little Woody People.
Mersons was suggested as an alternative. Instead of my people, it can be my persons. I think we can still use the word. We just can't call our company or our product Meeple. I think that was the primary source of their ire. Copyright and trademark law is complicated and weird. I don't even pretend to understand.
Especially cross-country.
International, yep, yeah. Absolutely. So into the void of tabletop spaceship games, I will gesture towards Mike Hutchinson. Mike Hutchinson has designed a number of extremely good tabletop miniatures rule sets, among them Gaslands and A Billion Suns. And he recently announced a whole bunch of products that are in the pipeline and projects that I'm very interested in. One of them is Incunabula, which is a little bit of a ways off. He's had an adventure system called Perilous Tales, which he says might get some kind of boxed release with all the tokens and cards necessary to play. I'd be very interested in that when and if it ever hits crowdfunding. There's also the possibility of Gaslands XL for large numbers of cars engaging with each other.
Oh,
at
I was
once.
Hoping they were just like bigger. You got like your big Tonka trucks on the table and
just
you start...
larger volume of units in a somewhat simplified way. But perhaps most salient to our interests is a project called Space Gits. Now, originally I was utterly uninterested because this is sort of an homage to the sort of 1980s Games Workshop Drunken Orcs kind of thing, which is not my bag. But here's the thing. Dexterity, Walker. I'll just tell you how the damage system works. Because firing, fighting, movement, all based on dexterity. But the thing that I find most interesting is the damage system. Every time you take a point of damage, you have to stack up a d6. And every time you move your unit, you have to move the stack. And if the stack falls over, so do you.
Oh, no.
So I'm very much looking forward to Space Gits. I'll happily give that a try, even if it is silly and thematically not necessarily my taste. But the intersection of tabletop miniatures and dexterity is an underused intersection. And I absolutely adore Flick Fleet. So I'm very much looking forward to trying Space Gits, as well as, frankly, looking at any rule set that Mike Hutchinson puts out, because he's a very interesting designer.
That's the news, and why it doesn't matter. Now on to the topic of the week, which is the 180.
Now, you initially suggested this topic, and then immediately thereafter, I'm going to try to quote you directly here, you said, I don't really have many things to say because I'm always right the first time.
That could be a slight misquote.
No, that is totally how you sound, and I would remember. I remember these things exactly because I'm always right the first time. Hold on, I think I heard myself right now.
I think I finished it off with, and everybody should know it.
That definitely sounds like you. So these are games where we've changed our opinions on things. Now, this can be after more plays or even possibly after a first play, because Walker, after his first turn, he makes up his mind about a game definitively. That's what makes him such a good board game reviewer.
That's right. And I just don't even finish playing.
Why bother? That's why it's a waste of time.
I say this game is dumb.
Yeah.
I flip the table and I go upstairs. This game is dumb. You're all dumb. I'm out.
That sounds like you. Okay. So what are some games you've changed your mind about, Walker?
All right. I have Ark Nova. I have read the rules for Ark Nova. I played the first time I played Ark Nova. Because, you know, you don't, the way I play games, I don't concentrate on it as a whole. I usually just concentrate on parts of it.
Yeah, find a fun thing to do and really exploit that, or
see how a mechanism is working and say, that's an interesting mechanism. I loved how the scoring worked, how there was like a crossover at the end.
Yes.
And so at first play, I didn't realize that it was a deck milling game.
Ah, the deck milling game. Your hatred of the deck milling game.
And then I think Spirit Island, even though people don't say it's, I think Spirit Island sort of fell in. The first time I played Spirit Island,
I'm not okay. That's fine. I'm saying to me.
Okay.
I'm allowed to think the way I want.
I suppose that's true.
And so on future plays of Ark Nova, I realized that the deck is so bloated. It's hard to get the cards you need. I know you need to just, you know, change your thinking on the way through, change your paths to fit the cards.
And get good,
apparently.
Yeah, yeah.
But that's just not what I want to. I don't want to. And yes. Anyway, Ark Nova.
Yeah, I was fortunate enough to come into Ark Nova forearmed with the knowledge that it was probably very much like games that I didn't want to play. So I often find that for a certain formative period of my hobby existence, I was making very strong negative reactions to solo modes. Like, I'd get a new game, I was super excited. Oh, it's got a solo mode, I'll try it out solo. Until I realized, you know, very much the dominant design model is that the solo mode often is just this entirely separate thing that doesn't really bear much resemblance to the actual game itself. Now, this wasn't the fault of one of my biggest 180s, which was Gloomhaven. I played it solo for the first time, strongly disliked it. There was part of me that was inclined not to play it again. And it was vaguely guiltily that I suggested it to, I believe it was Dr. Stallone, to play it again. And like, holy crap, this is amazing. And so now I've learned my lesson and I don't lead with the solo mode unless it's very clear that the solo mode is, you know, if it's a multiplayer solitaire game, Imperium Legends and Imperium Classics is an example that comes to mind. You can start with the solo mode there. That's fine. But other than that, I just don't lead with solo modes anymore because it forces me to get a false impression. And I'm very happy that I was able to get that second play of Gloomhaven, and otherwise I would have been in serious trouble.
So way back when it was Stick, Stick, Rock, and then Agricola came out, it was this very harsh game where you had to feed your workers every round, and then you got cards from this massive deck, and everyone's cards were way better than yours, and I hated everything about it.
Wow. I don't remember you ever expressing things that strongly.
This was a long time ago.
Okay.
The first play of Agricola first came out, and then it took quite a few years later for me to play it again and understand that it was, in fact, a fantastic game. Because even though the decks of cards are large and it's hard to, you know, suss out all of the cards, that how useful they are and how they will interact with what you're doing, you get a sort of vibe for a certain deck after a while. And much like Gaia Project, you learn how to, you know, produce the goods in order to feed your people and actually get ahead. So you can start getting even more workers. And the 180 on Agricola.
So you disliked it even before you played Caverna?
Yes.
Oh, wow. Okay. I had always thought that it was just that you preferred Caverna. I didn't realize that your initial reaction had been so negative.
It's true.
It's been quite the redemption arc. I've had a similar turnaround with respect to a lot of level 99 games. Level 99 games, very often, I immediately liked Battlecon, but a lot of their games are premised on excess. And more is more, and just loading you with tremendous numbers of card sets and options and various things to do. Seldom do they want to overload you in terms of mechanisms, though. And I had a very negative reaction for my first few games of Millennium Blades, because I didn't see the variety. You know, there'd be this huge card market, this massive ability to customize your deck. But you start with a deck that kind of works. And because I wasn't playing very well, because I'm so naturally predisposed to be so conservative, I would mostly stick with that deck the entire game. And so it felt like this two-hour experience of mostly nothing, of just getting the cards you need for just selling them off for points, because you can get points by winning tournaments and by selling off cards. But that was just because, I'll say it perfectly transparent, I needed to get good. I needed to learn that you need to be able to take advantage of those opportunities to completely revolutionize your deck from round to round.
You got to scrap your cards.
Yeah. Otherwise, you're not really playing the game. And indeed, if you're not really playing Millennium Blades, it's not very good. And I just, I just needed to learn how to do that. And sure enough, now that I do, I really enjoy Millennium Blades. Something similar with Argent the Consortium and other level 99 games. I've been very clear over the course of this podcast how initially I felt it was kind of overlong and didn't really lead to a good information flow. But proper room setup and play by the Summer Break expansion, I now think that Argent the Consortium is great in terms of the heavier worker placement games. Absolutely worth the rules grit. Absolutely worth the time time commitment. Just if you're not going to... if you're not going to release information properly into the system, and if you're going to play the default system properly, it's not to my taste. But now that I know how to approach level 99 games, these specific ones, I tend to enjoy these specific titles a lot more.
I have Terraforming Mars on my list. It's just one of these games that hit, you know, the majority. Once again, needing to, you know, cycle the cards, mill the deck, trying to get cards you want. Also, the game started to feel the same every time you played. And then they came out with, you know, one too many expansions, right? It was one of these sort of game bloats where, you know, well, which ones are we going to play with? You know, how does this one work again?
Mm-hmm.
Box was too full and started to dislike Terraforming Mars.
Yeah, it was the Terraforming Mars warning that made me know to not expect too much out of Ark Nova, frankly. I had the same experience with Legacy of You, not the bloat. Legacy of You remains remarkably tight. I talked about this a few weeks ago. Every game just felt the same. There wasn't enough variety. It's a very, very limited, very small optimization puzzle, and it shakes out the same way every time. I thoroughly enjoyed it for a couple plays, enjoyed it a fair bit for a couple more, but then it was just like, I've been here. I've done this. I've done the exact same thing. I know what next turn is going to look like. I know what the turn after that is going to look like, so why bother? And ended up packing that away even before the campaign was done. Of course, campaign systems, generally, we've been very clear about our feelings about campaigns. I still remember when campaigns were absolutely a selling point. I remember the first campaign I ever did in my modern hobby life. It was Mordheim. It was lovely. It was thoroughly unbalanced after three scenarios. We still kept doing it. It was fun. Now, not so much.
So my first few plays of Argent the Consortium were not good for my particular play style.
Yep.
Because, you know, it was sort of like the Galaxy Trucker thing. Do I want to waste time looking at victory point cards? Why do I care about
that? That's that information flow that I was talking about.
Exactly. I want to have fun doing my thing over here. But in Argent Consortium, it's very important to know which cards are going to score. There's this giant pool of cards that are all face down.
The eponymous consortium, yes.
And you have to start looking and remembering what they all are.
Yep.
And so later knowing
what the victory conditions are, yes.
So later on in my gaming life, I learned to appreciate that much more, and now Argent Consortium is a fantastic game.
Should we go back to Galaxy Trucker? So if we went back to Galaxy Trucker, I didn't think so. No. just want to see things blow
up. It's too
silly
fun, yeah. I play it different than other people.
You actually look down on people who look at the cards in advance.
That's a lie.
You have said very disparaging things. I've been at those tables, Walker, because that's the first thing I do. I put down a single component, and I then start looking at the objective cards, and sometimes when I do so, I hear some kind of derisive snort or sneer coming from you.
Fake news.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm glad you come around to Argent. I think, you know, not entirely unlike Federation. It's the kind of thing that's good to have in rotation, good to have around, very happy to play every now and then. Same thing with Anachrony, you know, heavier worker placement games, although I guess Anachrony and Argent are much heavier than Federation, but in terms of like having them around for notation. Similarly, in terms of learning to appreciate games how they're meant to be played, is a lot of block war games. So I'm thinking particularly about some of the work by Craig Bazink and by by Dalgliesh. Things like Wizard Kings, Napoleon, the Waterloo Campaign, Rommel in the Desert, stuff like that. My natural temptation when playing a war game is, you know, there's a certain sort of default vestigial troops on a map logic that takes over. And it's like, well, what I want to do is I want to get my best strength forward and apply it to their weakest point and just shove real hard and then toss the dice or throw the cards or whatever and win some fights. A lot of block war games aren't like that. And Napoleon, the Waterloo Campaign in particular, is much more about cat and mouse and trying to cut off supply lines and knowing that pitched battles are seldom in your interest. And so it took me a while to learn how to play them properly. Again, I was operating on instincts from other games, and I wasn't playing them properly. And consequently, when played improperly, the games were not very enjoyable for me. I just, like, why isn't it working? It's like, well, it's not working because you're not doing it right. And I don't think this is so much a question of fragility. It's a little bit about fragility, but I think it's more about preconceived notions on my part. Another thing that I initially didn't like about block war games was that a lot of them are premised on engagement limits. You know, every round, only a certain number of troops can cross this border. And so knowing how to reinforce a fight, this is especially true in Triumph and Tragedy, a game that I immediately enjoyed, for what it's worth, by Craig Mazenk. But by that point, I'd already come around on a lot of block war games. And now I really like Hexside Limits. Unless the maps are not well done. But generally speaking, a lot of them are well done. So there you have it.
So I think computerizing games will bring out different aspects of them. Like either you'll enjoy them more or you'll enjoy them less. My example would be Memoir 44. I loved Memoir 44. Mm. And I think if I played it on the table again against another player, I think I'd still enjoy it. But playing it against an AI just... And because it goes so fast, it really brings out the randomness of the dice, because you roll.
Yeah, there's a fair amount of randomness in all the Commands and Colors games, and Memoir 44 especially. Yes.
Yes, and when it goes so fast that's all you really are focusing on, it really makes it an unfun experience.
That's one of the I have a similar reaction to a lot of computerized adaptation of board games. I just start playing too quickly for my own good. There's something about the physicality of board games that I really appreciate in terms of centering my decision-making process. That's less about any specific adaptations than adaptations in general. I've been very clear over the years that I don't really like playing digital board games. And so, you know, COVID hit pretty hard as far as my hobby life was concerned. Yeah, I remember your stories about Memoir being similar.
Lastly for me, I have a couple games that I did 180 in the middle of the game.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Right. So playing Battlestar Galactica, the board game, you start off, it's like, oh, you get to move around the ship. You have little actions there. Oh, yeah, now there's a mission or something, right? And we're all going on the mission. We're playing cards into the stack. Oh, that's going to show, you know, who's good and who's evil, and it's going to wash out. And that's really interesting. And then you're like, how many more times? Are we gonna do this? How long is this game? And then I'm done. The other one was War Chest, which was unfortunate, right? I think both had this. It's like we're playing it. We're like, this is great.
Yes,
we're moving the tokens around. Interesting fights. Interesting battle. Like table presence and pushing each other around. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, why isn't this done?
Well, I don't think it was the duration. It was just more the specific nature of the end
game. Well, that's what I meant. It's like this should have been over already. Not that the time was taking too long. It's like there should have been a deciding factor that stopped this.
Yeah. Yeah. My unit has been crippled. Why am I being forced to continue dealing with this problem?
Yeah.
In a way that makes the end game all but obvious, but we engage in this attritional problem. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, like I said, I've got all the expansions now. We will revisit it soon, I'm sure. And we'll see if maybe these new
Everything
newer
else
units.
By Trevor Benjamin and David Thompson is so good. I keep assuming that the problem has to be with me. I don't know what it is.
Yeah, maybe like the reinforcement of the units, making them stronger. Maybe we're not playing it right.
Well, no, because that's the trick, right? I think that's one of the things that connects a lot of this, is that you're not playing it right is the most facile response to somebody not enjoying a game. It happens every time.
Yeah.
And most of the time, it's facile nonsense. Right now, you're not playing it right in terms of you got this rule wrong is, of course, an issue. And in times when that happens, we revisit games and we talk about that. But sometimes, in point of fact, we've played a game wrong, realized that we played it wrong, and so we don't talk about it at all and wait to revisit it. But the line between I needed to appreciate how this game was to be played well and therefore enjoy it more, like I feel with Millennium Blades, versus you're not playing it right in that you shouldn't really be following the obvious course that the rules have set out to you.
Yeah, you should be playing the way that you enjoy playing those type of games. You have to play it the way the game wants you to play it.
Yes. So the line between you have to appreciate it properly and the game is just fragile and poorly designed is a subtle one, but it is nonetheless one that you often have to tread. It's tricky. And that's going to do it for this episode of So Very Wrong About Games. Thank you for joining us. Please do visit our website at sowronggames.com. There's tons of stupid stuff there. And if you like our stupid stuff, well, some of it's there.
Peace!
You've been listening to So Very Wrong About Games, a board gaming podcast about board games produced by Michael Walker and edited by Mark McNeil. You can find all our information at sowronggames.com. Special thanks to What Does It Eat for allowing us to use their most excellent song, FOS, as our intro. You can find them at whatdoesiteat.com. We hope to see you again soon, and as always, try to be right, but remember, you're so very wrong.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.